Well, tonight we're going to start to consider the seven night visions of Zechariah. As far as sources go, Brother Thomas Eureka, Graham Mansfield, Zechariah Expositor, Brother H.P., Mansfield Story of the Bible, Volume 4, Brother C.C. Walker, Theophany, Brother Carter, Prophets After the Exile, Worthy has a book, Seven Night Visions. Listen to a class by Brother Ron Cowie, 1999 Rocky Mountain Bible School. There's some study notes from the Golden Grove Ecclesia in South Australia. So the aim of the class, or aim of the talks, is to show how Zechariah's seven night visions were a source of encouragement for those toiling in Jerusalem in Zechariah's day. We also want to look at the encouragement that believers since that time have received by reading about these visions. And I intend to provide you, God willing, with an overview of each of the seven night visions, and to look at as many details as possible in the time allotted. Obviously, there's only so much you can cover in three classes or three exhortations. So out of necessity, our coverage is going to be sketchy at best. However, I do hope that through these classes will pique your interest, so that when you go home, you will do a further study of Zechariah on your own. I did pass out some handouts. All the overheads that I'll be using tonight, and God willing, the next two nights, make copies of. I also gave you a copy of the Golden Grove South Australian notes where they did a verse. So just to kind of give you an idea on the format that we're going to try to use, cover the most amount of material as possible. I've decided to try to use overheads that have a drawing of each night vision and a corresponding summary that I got out of the expositor book. So what we'll plan to do is read their summary, or an excerpt of their summary, to give a flavor of what the vision is going to be about, and then we'll go back and we'll look at some details. I've also gave you copies of the quotes. I'll be having, over the course of the next, I'll have some long quotations. Thought it would be better if you had it so you could read along. It'll be easier to follow that way. So then once we've established an overview or a big picture of the vision, then I hope that we can at least get familiar with these enough that Zechariah, if you haven't looked at these night visions, very interesting study. So as far as what we plan to do, God willing, is tonight we'll cover the introduction and visions 1, 2, and 3. Tomorrow night, visions 4 and 5, and then Wednesday night, visions 6 and 7 with a conclusion. So Brother Brian's class this morning on Ezra and Brother Max Haggai talked last night served as a great background for the time period we're dealing with in Zechariah. But as you know, Zechariah and Haggai were contemporary prophets who were on the scene at the end of the 70-year captivity spoken of by Jeremiah and Daniel. The Babylonians were conquered by the Medo-Persians, and Cyrus issued a decree in Ezra 1:2 that the Jews should return home and rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. This is going to be kind of a rehash of some of the things that have already been. But not only that, but verses 7 to 11 in Ezra 1 tell us that Cyrus gave them the vessels of the temple that were taken by Nebuchadnezzar, as well as a huge sum of money to help pay for the work given to Sheshbazzar, prince of Judah, who would coordinate and organize the return. Ezra 7:9 tells us that the journey from Babylon to Jerusalem took 4 months. It would not have been an easy trip. Even so, we're told in Ezra chapter 2, verses 64 and 65, which Brian read this morning, there were 49,697 people who decided to make the trek back. From the description that they give in the following verses that follow that, look at the number of animals they had. They really didn't have that many animals. It kind of tells us that it was probably, they weren't really a wealthy class, obviously, in exile. You know, they would have been struggling. They decided to make the trip. So tired and dusty from their trip, one can only imagine what went through their minds as they arrived to see the daunting task that lie ahead of them. For the city and the temple sat in ruin. Nothing was left but piles of burnt rubble. But the people were enthusiastic and determined to build. Ezra 3 tells us that they built an altar and kept the Feast of Tabernacles. Spirits were high. They did not remain that way for long. It seems not everyone was enthusiastic about this new work that the Israelites were undertaking. Ezra 4 describes how adversaries in the surrounding area, particularly the Samaritans, did everything they could to hinder the work. They tried to sabotage, harass, bribe, and use political means to stop the building. In fact, we're told in Ezra 4:21 that the Jews were commanded to cease from that work. Now, this would have indeed been a tough obstacle to overcome. Instead of showing their faith by making preparations and planning for the time when the work would recommence, they gave up the building project and started working on their own homes, as were the first chapter of Haggai. They were waiting for the 70-year period of the destruction of the temple to be completed before they started up again. Of course, this was just an excuse, because their homes were destroyed at the same time the temple was. They have a problem working on their own home, preparing for those. This went on for about 14 or 15 years, give or take. And in the second year of Darius, the prophets Haggai and Zechariah stirred up the people to action with words of encouragement. Brother Brian read those today in Ezra 4:25 to chapter 5, verse 1. Chief among those who were stirred up were Zerubbabel and Joshua. The voice of Haggai was heard first as he exhorted them to consider your ways. They needed to stop pursuing material things and set their sights on spiritual things, get to work. Zechariah was heard next, and he exhorted them to despise not the day of small things. He promised a blessing for those who faithfully labored on behalf of Yahweh. The work of the truth is often unglamorous and involves hard work. Of course, the Jews' adversaries did not look favorably upon this newfound zeal of the Israelites and appealed in a letter to Darius in Ezra 5. Ezra chapter 6 tells us that Darius not only confirmed the decree of Cyrus, but also ordered the adversaries to help with financial and material support. As far as the man Zechariah himself, we don't know a lot about him. We know that he was a priest. He's mentioned in both in Ezra and Nehemiah, that he's both a prophet and a priest. And as such, he would naturally have had a keen interest in the rebuilding of the temple and would have received great joy in his visions of that great and glorious temple, the house of prayer for all nations, to be built in the future after the Messiah appears. The book starts out in the 8th month of Darius, in Darius' second year, roughly 520 B.C., give or take. The theme of the book is given in the names noted in Zechariah 1:1. In the 8th month, in the second year of Darius, came the word of Yahweh unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo, the prophet. Zechariah means Yahweh hath remembered. Berechiah means Yahweh hath blessed. Iddo means the appointed time. So as we're told this morning, taken together, we're told that that Yahweh hath remembered and Yahweh hath blessed at the appointed time. That, again, is the theme of the book. What great words of encouragement and comfort the people received, knowing that they needed to patiently wait for the blessings of Yahweh, which would surely come. Zechariah 1:2 tells us that Yahweh has been displeased with displeasure, emphasizing Yahweh's anger over their unfaithfulness and apathy concerning spiritual matters. They were neglecting the work of rebuilding the temple and restoring divine worship. In verses 3 to 6, the people are exhorted to be not like their fathers, who provoked Yahweh to anger. The 70-year captivity should have reminded them of that. Let's turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 36. 2 Chronicles chapter 36, and let's read verses 15 to 17. Yahweh Elohim of their fathers sent to them by his messengers, rising up betimes and sending, because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. But they mocked the messengers of God, despised his words, and misused his prophets, until the wrath of Yahweh arose against his people, till there was no remedy. Therefore he brought upon them the king of the Chaldees, who slew their young men with a sword in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion upon young man or maiden, old man or him that stooped for age, gave them all into his hand. Back in Zechariah, we have the militant name of Yahweh, Yahweh of hosts, he who will be armies, who will be manifest in armies, used to grab their attention and let them know how serious a matter unfaithfulness and apathy really are, because it's also used for encouragement. But it's also used for encouragement in the fact that Yahweh will protect those who labor on his behalf. By the way, Yahweh of hosts is used 9 times in this first chapter. Fitting, for nine is the number of divine judgment. And this chapter deals with the divine judgment shown firstly against their unfaithful fathers, and secondly against the nations, both at the time of Zechariah and ultimately in a future fulfillment. As far as the timeline goes, this is taken from the expositor. We had some discussions prior to about using Brother Thomas's chronicle. The dates that we have here has B.C. 519. It was in the 11th month Zechariah receives his first seven visions. First, Zechariah chapter 1, verse 7 through chapter 6, actually is verse. And then second year of Darius, 8th month, Zechariah's introductory exhortation. And then 3 months later, the 11th month. What I thought we'd do before we actually get into the first night vision, kind of go through an overview of what the visions are. So Zechariah's first chapter is broken down this way. It's chapter 1, verses 1 through 6, sort of an intro. It talks about true repentance will be rewarded. Vision 1, first vision, is chapter 1, verses 7 to 17. This is the vision of the man among the myrtles, and Zion shall see peace and prosperity. Vision 2, chapter 1, verses 18 through 21, the vision of the four horns and the four carpenters. Message is the glorified saints terrify Israel's adversaries. Vision 3, this is chapter 2. It's the man with the measuring line. Message is that Jerusalem's downtreading is limited, for Yahweh will dwell in the midst of his people. Vision 4, chapter 3, change of raiment for Joshua the high priest. It references the branch and the stone. The atoning work of Christ results in immortality for himself and his fellow laborers, saints, and multitudinous manifestation. Vision 5 is Zechariah chapter 4. The vision of the lampstand, the two olive trees, great mountain, and the two sons of oil. The message is the whole earth illuminated by divine. Vision 6, chapter 5. The flying scroll, the woman in the ephah, and the flight of the storks. The message is the great apostasy develops out of Judaism into spiritual Babylon. And the last of the seven night visions is chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. And that concerns the four chariots of war and two mountains of brass. Multitudinous Christ's conquest of the Gentile dominions of the... Brother Mansfield has an expositor on page 49, just to say. Notice that these seven visions commence with a statement that Yahweh is sore displeased with the nations, chapter 1:15, and conclude after the four warrior chariots have completed their mission with a statement, they have quieted my spirit. In these seven visions, Yahweh strongly affirms his covenant to redeem and restore his people. Seven is the covenant number. They are graduated visions, revealing the following interesting sequence. One, Zion shall see prosperity due to the work of the four craftsmen who will cause the downtreading of Jerusalem to cease. Jerusalem's glory will be graced by the coming high priest, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will cause the lampstand of the Spirit to illuminate the world, darkened by apostasy. Through his four warrior chariots, will overthrow the forces of the Gentiles. That's the message. Okay, so the first night vision. Again, what we said we would try to do is to read the summary to get a flavor of what the vision is about, and then we'll look at some details. Between Zechariah 1:7 and 6:8, the prophet records seven visions that he received during the course of one remarkable night. In the first, he was shown a man upon a red horse standing among myrtle trees. Behind him were three other riders on horses. From the darkness, these four looked out upon the world and saw with dissatisfaction that whilst the Gentiles were at ease, Jerusalem was in distress. The prophet then heard good and comfortable words spoken in regard to Jerusalem and Zion. He heard the promise given that Yahweh's house would be completed, and through prosperity, the cities would spread abroad. The vision, therefore, was encouraging to those who were then laboring under difficulties and in the face of the opposition of neighboring nations who were at ease. It revealed to them that their immediate work would be brought to successful conclusion, whilst also revealing that what they were doing was typical of a greater destiny in the future in which they could share, demonstrated that from the shadows, Yahweh overlooked his people for good. His eyes were upon them. The myrtle trees that surrounded the man of the vision are symbolic of the Feast of Tabernacles. The Feast of Tabernacles was the Feast of Harvest, deliverance, and rejoicing. It foreshadowed the glory of the millennium. Thus, the vision had a primary application to the days of Zechariah and a secondary application to the days of the future restorer of all things. So verses 7 and 8, Zechariah chapter 1. Zechariah received each of the night visions in one night, on the 24th day of the 11th month, Darius' second year. Each not only had application to the rebuilding of the temple currently underway at Zechariah's time, but also had a future application. We notice that they were given at night, which speaks to us of the Gentile night period in which even we are living under at the present. The man in verse 8 is the Hebrew word ish, upright, prominent man. We're told in Jude 9, the angel of Yahweh was none other than Michael. Let's take a look at verse 11. Verse 11, it says, the angel of Yahweh has stood among the myrtle trees. Chapter 3, verse 1, also talks about the angel of Yahweh. 2, Jude 9, please, establish the point. It says, yet Michael the archangel, when contending with the devil or the adversary, he disputed about the body of Moses, durst not bring against him a railing accusation, but said, Yahweh, or the Lord, rebuke thee. And as we were kind of a little premature in looking at that verse, that does establish the fact that it is Michael, the archangel, Yahweh here. Therefore, it's very possible that the angel that talked with me, spoken of in these night visions, was the communicating angel. More than likely, it was probably Gabriel. Gabriel spoke with Daniel. Let's take a look at Luke chapter 1. Luke chapter 1. Verses 19 and 20. Luke 1:19, and the angel answering said unto him, I am Gabriel, that stand in the presence of God, and am sent to speak unto thee, and to show thee these glad tidings. Verse 26, and in the sixth month, the angel Gabriel was sent from God unto the city of Galilee, named So we see this angel figure, who represents Christ as the commander of the multitudinous hosts, is riding upon, or controlling, a red horse. Let's take a look at Isaiah chapter 55. Isaiah 55, verse 4. Behold, I have given him for a witness to the people, a leader and commander to the people. Look at also the Apocalypse chapter 19. Apocalypse 19, verses 11 through 16. I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he doth judge and make war. His eyes were as a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns. He had a name written that no man knew but he himself. And he was clothed with the vesture dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. Armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean. And out of his mouth goeth a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations, and he should rule them with a rod of iron. And he treadeth the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. He hath on his vesture and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Zechariah chapter 1:8 says, I saw by night, and behold, a man riding upon a red horse. Horses were a symbol of warfare. Write some of these references down. We won't. Zechariah 10:3, which we will look at. Proverbs 21:31. Jeremiah 8:6. Job 39:19-25, of course we just read in the Apocalypse, chapter 19, verses 11-16, establish the fact that horses symbolize warfare. Chapter 10, mine anger was kindled against the shepherds, and I punished the goats. For Yahweh of hosts hath visited his flock, the house of Judah, and hath made them as his goodly horse in the battle. So in Zechariah's first night vision, there were four horses, four being the number of military encampment of Israel. Talk a little bit more about the number four when we get to the second night vision. Well, the leader was riding a red-colored horse. The red-colored horse indicates bloodshed. Psalm 149 describes the saints executing vengeance upon the nations. There was another red horse behind him, well as a speckled bay or sorrel, indicating ill fortune or famine. A white horse which could indicate either leprosy or pestilence or conquest and righteousness. Verse 8 tells us that he stood among the myrtle trees. Standing represents being at rest, his work being accomplished. From this vantage point, he commands his followers. The word bottom in verse 8, better rendered shade, appropriate. Very refreshing to come to rest after working hard in the hot sun by sitting under the shade. Zechariah and those laboring in the construction could well relate to that. Brother Walker states, "The shade in question is that of the wings or hand Almighty, who has brought up Jesus and his brethren from the shadow of death." From Eureka Volume 1, page 55, the Logos edition, Brother Thomas says, "These considerations fix the time of Zechariah's horses at rest. At the Feast of Tabernacles, first ensuing, when the Holy One of Israel, the man on the red horse, shall have completed his conquest, shall be Prince of Peace in the Israel. He and his cavalry march to and fro through the earth with blood, signified by redness, famine by the bay, pestilence by the pale or whitish, until the earth is reduced to submission and obtains rest from these calamities." This vision is reproduced in the Apocalypse, only a more extended scale. The myrtle trees were used in the Feast of Tabernacles. See that from Leviticus chapter 23, verses 40 to 43. It represents Israel's restoration to fruitfulness, thus indicating Yahweh's purpose of establishing peace, deliverance after the conquest. Through these visions, Zechariah is shown asking questions, and the angel helps him to understand. For example, in verse 9, he asks the question, "O my Lord, what are these?" He wants to understand these things. Therefore, Zechariah represents us and all those who would diligently seek after the meaning of the angel that talked with Zechariah in verse 10 refers to the man that stood among the myrtle trees. Here the commanding angel, whereas verse 11 tells us the angel of Yahweh, which so is Michael, explains to Zechariah and the angels fulfill the role of being the eyes of Yahweh and subduing the enemies of Israel. At the same time, he is telling Zechariah that this work will be accomplished by the saints in the future. Verse 11 tells us, "We have walked to and fro through all the earth, and behold, all the earth sitteth still and is at rest," thus indicating that the period of time where the nations are subdued before Christ's reign of peace. In verse 12, we have the old familiar question that is asked by how long. Daniel wanted to know. Habakkuk wanted to know. In this instance, notice that as Michael himself asked the question, even the angels themselves desire to look into these matters. We're told in verse 15 that Yahweh was not happy that the nations that were hindering the work of building were. This displeased Yahweh. As is often the case, the nations that Yahweh used to punish or test his people went beyond their mandate and enjoyed their work of affliction against Yahweh's people too much. Verse 2 told us that Yahweh was displeased with your fathers, but now we're told that he is very sore displeased. Rotherham has for verse 15, "And with a great displeasure I am displeased with the careless or proud nations, in that when I was displeased for a little, then they helped forward the calamity." Septuagint has, "And I am very angry with the nations that combined to attack her, for as much as I indeed was a little angry, but they combined to attack her for evil." In Zechariah's time, they experienced this with the Samaritans. He receives comforting and assuring words in verses 16 and 17, which ultimately will be fulfilled in the future. In verses 16 to 17, Yahweh says that his house shall be built in Jerusalem. The land will see prosperity. Zion shall be comforted. And Jerusalem will yet be chosen as his habitation. Okay, so the second night vision. So how would the blessings in verses 16 and 17 in the first night vision come to pass? Zechariah is given the second night vision as an explanation. Read our summary. This vision describes the conflict that would face Jerusalem throughout the ages. It prepares the prophet for an outline of the divine work with his people. Zechariah's attention is drawn to four horns. He is told that these represent Israel's enemies. He is then shown four carpenters and is told that these would overthrow the oppressors of Israel. So in this vision, Zechariah sees four horns that have not only scattered or tossed about Judah and Israel, but also Jerusalem herself. the city of the great king. From Daniel's prophecy, Zechariah would realize that these four horns represent the four great Gentile world powers. Babylon and Medo-Persia he would be familiar with, but Greece and Rome would be yet future from Zechariah's day. One would think that Jerusalem would be included in Judah, as that these are the horns that have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. You'd expect that Jerusalem would have been included in Judah. So why is she mentioned separately? Well, perhaps it may be to remind us that these Gentile powers have not only affected Yahweh's people politically, but also in a spiritual sense, both under the Mosaic order of things and ecclesiastically. Yahweh then saw four carpenters or artificers or engravers. These were highly skilled craftsmen. Again, this would be something familiar to Zechariah and those who were building the temple. They would realize that their adversaries would be subdued. Referring to these carpenters, Brother Carter states on page 52, "They are the builders of the age to come. They are the brethren of the carpenter of Nazareth." A beautifully fitting connection. He knew how to build wisely, whether houses or characters. His fellows also have graduated in his school, wise builders upon the foundation of Jesus Christ. In Eureka, volume 1, page 56, Brother Thomas states, "These four carpenters are therefore not Gentile, but of Jewish nationality, and are yet to be apocalypsed or revealed. We may here say in passing that they are the brethren of the carpenter's son, 1355. Quadrants of the man in the midst of the myrtle trees, the seraphim of Isaiah, the four cherubim of Ezekiel, and the four living ones of the apocalypse. These are they by whom the horns of the Gentiles are to be broken, and the holy land and city are to be avenged, and Zion comforted." So these really, they're all different presentations of the same thing. When he stated they were of Jewish nationality, I believe he was referring to true believers, including those who were or are Jewish by adoption. The word phrase in verse 21 means to shudder with terror or terrify. Vengeance is Yahweh's. In the future, the multitudinous Christ shall thrash the nations that dare to provoke their great king and who refuse to submit to his rule. The nations shall truly tremble and be afraid of his mighty power. Take a look at Micah chapter 7, verses 16 to 17. "The nations shall see and be confounded at all their might. They shall lay their hand upon their mouth. Their ears shall be deaf. They shall lick the dust like a serpent. They shall move out of their holes like worms of the earth. They shall be afraid of Yahweh our Elohim. They shall fear because of thee." So the third night vision. Third night vision is the man with the measuring line from Zechariah chapter 2. In his first vision, this is the summary. In his first vision, Zechariah saw that Yahweh, from the shadows, guided the destiny of Israel and through his divine army would oversee his experiences and move for its redemption. In the prophet's second vision, he was shown the means whereby the Gentiles would be terrified and overthrown. Now in this third vision, he is shown that Jerusalem's persecution is limited, and its ultimate exaltation to the supremacy of Yahweh's throne is sure. The prophet saw a man with a measuring line and learned the purpose of his labors. Jerusalem shall be inhabited, Israel shall be restored, and the glory will return. Again, the vision of the night has relation to the labors of the day of Judah's establishment. For a man with a measuring line must have been a familiar figure to the workers in the temple. The vision also provides a message of encouragement throughout the generations to our own time. Zechariah would surely be curious when these things should happen. The next night vision introduced Zechariah to a man, an Ish, with a measuring line in his hand. We need to take a closer look at this measuring line. The Hebrew word for line in chapter 3, verse 1 is Gebel, C-H-E-B-E-L, which means, according to Strong's, a rope as twisted. It comes from the root word, cable, C-H-A-B-A-L, which means to wind tightly as a rope, that is, to bind, specifically by a pledge, figuratively, to pervert, destroy, also to writhe in pain. This is different from the word line that is used in chapter 1, verse 6. There the word for line is kav, Q-A-V, which means a cord as connecting, especially for measuring, figuratively a rule. A kav is used for measuring size. Cable is, in this context, is used for measuring off for punishment. We see the latter used by David with the Moabites in chapter 2 of 2 Samuel chapter 8, verse 2. One line was for death and the other for slavery. 2 Samuel chapter 8, verse 2, speaking of David. And he smote Moab and measured them with a line, casting them down to the ground. Even with two lines measured he to put to death, and with one full line to keep alive. So the Moabites became David's servants and brought gifts. The one line was for death, and the other was for slavery. So in verse 2, Zechariah asked, "Whither goest thou?" And was told, "To measure Jerusalem, to see what is the breadth thereof, and what is the length thereof." Breadth and length, or as Brother Thomas states in Eureka Volume 1, page 56, he was told what the line of Jerusalem's humiliation extended to, but he was not informed of the number of the years that humiliation should continue. In other words, the extent and the duration of Jerusalem's punishment or downtreading would have an end. There is a set time to favor Zion. Psalm 102, verses 13 and 14. Psalm 102, starting in verse 13. Thou shalt arise and have mercy upon Zion, for the time to favor her, yea, the set time, is come. For thy servants take pleasure in her stones, and favor the dust thereof. This line is for judgment of Jerusalem, with the length showing how long the judgment would last, and the breadth showing how severe the punishment would be. Communicating angel was told in verse 4 to run, speak to this young man. And I've read several different Christadelphian expositions, each with a little different viewpoint on who is the young man referred to in verse 4. Let's go ahead and read that verse. It says, "He said unto him, Run, speak to this young man, saying, Jerusalem shall be inhabited as towns without walls, for the multitude of men and cattle therein." So it kind of gets, when you look at verse 3, it says, "And behold, the angel that talked with me went forth, and another angel went out to meet him." So you get starting to get a lot of hymns in there. It took me a little while to try to get that straight in my mind as to who was actually speaking and who they were speaking to. Who is this young man? Brother Mansfield in the expositor on page 65 believes that the young man is the measuring man or angel of verse 1, being called upon to stop the measuring for punishment. Zechariah notes by the Golden Grove Ecclesia and in Brother Ron Cowie's class, they both believe that the young man symbolizes those who had the mentality of putting their trust in actual walls for protection. They wanted physical walls there to feel comfortable. However, I happen to agree with Brother Carter, who states on page 55 that the young man is Zechariah himself. My reasons for believing this are as follows. Firstly, the words for man in verses 1 and 4 are different. Verse 1, you have, "I lifted up mine eyes again and looked, and behold, a man with a measuring line in his hand." Then run and speak to this young man in verse 4. In verse 1, the man is Ish. And in verse 4, it's Naar, N-A-A-R, which means young man. Brother Brian told us this morning that unlike Haggai, we know that Zechariah was a young man. Haggai, according to Haggai 2:3, probably saw Solomon's glorious temple before it was destroyed and was therefore an old man at this time. Zechariah, on the other hand, was the grandson of Iddo, who returned to the land with Zerubbabel, according to Nehemiah chapter 12, verse 4. So the young man aspect fits with Zechariah. Secondly, the job of the angel that talked with me, or the communicating angel, Gabriel, his job to talk to Zechariah. His job is to speak to people. He would be the one speaking to Zechariah. Therefore, I believe the hymn in verse 4 is the communicating angel sent to speak to Zechariah. And thirdly, Zechariah was an active participant in receiving these night visions. Sometimes I think we have a tendency to forget that these individuals that we read about in Scripture were real people with feelings and emotions just like you and me. if we aren't careful, we forget about how dramatic these events were to them, and they become just characters in a book. Zechariah, as a priest and a prophet, was greatly concerned and troubled, knowing that Jerusalem would suffer yet more. And with the measuring line, you know, he knew what the purpose was going to be. He was going to measure out punishment against Jerusalem. So the other angel, in verse 3, knowing Zechariah's love for Jerusalem and the people, wanted to put Zechariah's mind at ease and relieve his anxiety. Therefore, he gave Gabriel a message to give Zechariah to reassure him the blessings would indeed come upon Jerusalem. And this would have been comforting to Zechariah. The reassuring words that Zechariah would hear are given in verses 4 and 5. Jerusalem shall be inhabited as towns without walls for the multitude of men and cattle therein. And why would that be? For I, saith Yahweh, will be to her a wall of fire round about, and will be the glory in the midst of her. So although Zechariah and Haggai and their contemporaries would see blessings in their day, we know that this prophecy has yet a future fulfillment. Can anybody tell me they think this is showing here? The wall that they're putting up in Jerusalem. Or not Jerusalem, but in Israel. Just as a side note, I got this map off the website. It's Israel Ministry of Foreign Affairs website. And, you know, typical media coverage, you know, when you think of the wall, what do you think of? These big concrete structures that, you know, they're sealing these poor Palestinians out. Well, only 3.8% are actually walled sections. Over 95% is chain link fence. And the only reason why they have these concrete barriers is because the Palestinians, if they have tall buildings, through the cities with tall buildings, they had snipers on there picking off Israeli drivers as they were driving down the highway. So they put the wall up high enough so they cut off their line of fire. That's the only reason why they put those in there. Also, there was on that same website, and I can't remember if it was the last 3 years or something like that, there were, 3 years prior to that, there were 900 dead Israelis as a result of suicide bombings and Palestinians that would come in, terrorists that would come in and blow themselves up. 900 dead in Israel. And they said that's equivalent to 40,580 U.S. citizens. Size of their population, proportionally speaking, 40,580. United States would have a cow. They also had an interesting quote on there, and I thought this was a pretty interesting quote. It says, "The right of Palestinians to freedom of movement cannot take precedence over the right of Israelis to live." So anyway, this wall that they're putting up, Zechariah is told, "This for I, saith Yahweh, will be unto her a wall of fire round about, and will be the glory in the midst of her." Zechariah would have received comfort when told that Yahweh would be a wall of fire round about Jerusalem. The prophet would recall the times in Israel's history when Yahweh protected his people from the Egyptians by a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night, and from the Syrian army by horses and chariots of fire. Fleshly protection was not needed. We know that Jerusalem in the future will be under divine defense. Take a look at a few. Isaiah chapter 4. Verses 5 and 6. Isaiah 4, verses 5 and 6. "And Yahweh will create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion, and upon her assemblies, a cloud and smoke by day, and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For upon all the glory shall be a defense. There shall be a tabernacle for a shadow in the daytime from the heat, and for a place of refuge, and covert, storm, and from rain." Also in Isaiah chapter 60, verse 1. "Arise, shine, for thy light is come, and the glory of Yahweh is risen upon thee." Drop down to verses 18 through 20. "Violence shall no more be heard in thy land, wasting nor destruction within thy borders. But thou shalt call thy walls salvation, and thy gates praise. The sun shall be no more thy light by day, neither for brightness shall the moon give light unto thee. But Yahweh shall be unto thee an everlasting light, thy God, thy glory. Thy sun shall no more go down, neither shall thy moon withdraw itself. For Yahweh shall be thine everlasting light, and the days of thy mourning shall be ended." Also in Apocalypse chapter 21. Apocalypse 21, verses 10 through 12. "And he carried me away in spirit to a great and high mountain, and showed me that great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God, having the glory of God, and her light was like unto a stone most precious, even like a jasper stone, clear as crystal, and had a wall great and high, and had 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and names written thereon, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. For Yahweh will indeed be the glory in the midst of her. We know that the glory did not return in Zechariah's time, so therefore he was being told that Yahweh would appear or be in their midst at the end of the measuring line. Ezekiel tells us the glory departing in chapters 10 and 11, and also that the glory would return in the kingdom age to fill the house of prayer for all nations in chapter 43 and 44. Zechariah 2 mentions three times that Yahweh will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, verses 5, verses 10, and verse 11. Three is the number of divine perfection. The appeal went forth for Jews in exile to return. Look at Zechariah verses 6 and 7. Ho, ho, come forth and flee from the land of the north, saith Yahweh, for I have spread you abroad as the four winds of the heaven, saith Yahweh. Deliver thyself, O Zion, that dwellest with the daughter of Babylon. The land of the north, or Babylon, as we're told in verse 7, is specifically mentioned here as was applicable to Zechariah's time. But verse 6 tells us that they are spread abroad as the four winds of the heaven. This was accomplished by the Romans in AD 70, as predicted by the Lord Jesus Christ in the Mount Olive prophecy, Luke 21, verse 24, which for the sake of time we won't read. We know that the work of Elijah will be to gather the Jews from all points of the globe, north, south, east, and west, whether they be scattered. Look at one reference in that, Jeremiah chapter 16, 14 and 15. Therefore, behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that it shall no more be said, Yahweh liveth that brought up the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt, but Yahweh liveth that brought up the children of Israel from the land of the north, from all the lands whither he had driven them, and I will bring them again into their land that I gave unto their fathers. Back in Zechariah chapter 2, in verse 8, we're given an analogy as to the care that Yahweh has for his people. We realize just how jealous he is for them by thinking back to Zechariah chapter 1, verses 14 and 15, and even to the promise to Abraham in Genesis 12:3, I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee. Like poking someone in the eye, sure to get a strong reaction. Verse 8, for thus saith Yahweh of hosts, after the glory hath he sent me unto the nations that spoiled you, for he that toucheth you toucheth the apple of his eye. In regards to verses 6 to 9, Brother Thomas has this to say in Eureka, Volume 1, Psalm 57. Here is a call upon the Jews to rise against the governments of the nations, which says, ho, 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 come forth and flee from the land of the north. Here is a call upon the Jews to rise against the governments of the nations, and doubtless, because those governments will not regard the proclamation of the Apocalypse, chapter 14, verse 6 and 7, the mid-proclamation. Zion, thus appealed to, will respond to the invitation, and in concert with the four carpenters, the resurrected saints and the true believers living at the time of the proclamation, proceed to break in pieces and consume the power of the nations. These are to be spoiled and subjugated by their servants, the Jews. And after that, the glory will be apocalypsed. After the glory is apocalypsed in Jerusalem. In other words, after Messiah effects his entrance into Jerusalem, the work begins that is to result in removing the veil from the mind of Israel with respect to Jesus, in their restoration to Palestine, in the subjugation of the nations, subsequent enlightenment. But that time, when the glorious King will be among them, they will sing and rejoice, and they shall know that Yahweh manifested in a multitude will dwell in their midst. Look at Zephaniah chapter 3, verses 14 to 17. Sing, O daughter of Zion, shout, O Israel, be glad and rejoice with all the heart, O daughter of Jerusalem. Yahweh hath taken away thy judgments, he hath cast out thine enemy. The King of Israel, even Yahweh, is in the midst of thee. Thou shalt not see evil any more. In that day it shall be said to Jerusalem, fear thou not, and to Zion, let not thine hands be slack. Yahweh, thy God, in the midst of thee is mighty. He will save. He will rejoice over thee with joy. He will rest in his love. He will joy over thee with singing. Last reference, Isaiah chapter 12, 5 and 6. Isaiah chapter 12, 5. Sing unto Yahweh, for he hath done excellent things. This is known in all the earth. Cry out and shout, thou inhabitant of Zion, for great is the Holy One in Israel. Great is the Holy One of Israel in the midst of thee. We'll close by looking at a quote by Brother Ullman regarding verse 13, where it says, "Be silent, O all flesh, before Yahweh. Be silent, O all flesh." With the establishment of the kingdom, Jews and Gentiles will become aware of their past ungodliness and foolishness. More than this, they will come to a shocked realization that their forebears, generation after generation, conducted themselves and educated their children in the same ways of sin, treating Yahweh and His Word with contempt. Gentiles shall come unto thee from the ends of the earth and shall say, "Surely our fathers have inherited lies, vanity, and things wherein there is no profit." Little wonder that they will bow in reverence before the Mighty One of heaven and earth, heeding the command, "Be silent, O all flesh, before Yahweh. He is raised up out of his holy habitation." If this is to be the attitude displayed before the kingdom age by previously wicked and ignorant Jews and Gentiles, what, we might ask, of the ecclesia of today? Is Yahweh held in the awe and reverence that is his due? Are brethren and sisters mindful, as for example, when they come before the table of the Lord, of the reality that they are in the presence of deity through his angels? It is so easy to be very careless and oblivious to the need for reverence and divine worship. Paul offers sober words of advice for all. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. So, God willing, tomorrow night we'll look at the fourth and fifth night visions. I wish we would have had time to read these verses, so that a lot of times when it's not fresh in your mind, you don't get as much out of it. But the next two night visions are going to be in chapter 3 and chapter 4. One is 10 verses and the other is 14. So half time between now and tomorrow night, if you could read those, that might help to make it a little bit more.